ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
Well, let's put our scuba gear on board the submarine and head out to the glorious Australian coastal waterways. About a fortnight ago, the CSIRO's research vessel investigator found Tasmania's Blythe Star shipwreck off the state's southwest coast. And in April, the wreck of the SS Montevideo Maru was located in the South China Sea more than 80 years after it sunk off the coast of the Philippines. It was considered for Australia the worst maritime disaster in peace or war, carried over 1,000 prisoners of war, including 850 Australians from Rabaul. It was targeted by a US submarine. They thought it was a Japanese cargo vessel. And the location of the wreck, of course, which is a war grave, had remained unsolved until it was discovered 4,000 metres beneath the sea. Leading that exhibition was the Silent World Foundation, a not-for-profit organisation with a focus on supporting and promoting Australian maritime archaeology. Joining us in the studio tonight, John Mullen is the chairman of the National Maritime Museum and director of the Silent World Foundation, who most recently led the expedition to find the Montevideo Maru. John is also the chair of Telstra and is a very avid collector of maritime objects. John, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening to you.
I had to put that in because
you
have got some great stuff. Just come a little closer to that microphone, Willis. Yep. That'd be great. Also joining us, Emily Jatiff, a maritime archaeologist. How good would that be, who assisted the CSIRO's investigator in their confirmation of the discovery of the Blythe Star? Emily, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, thanks for having me.
How do you get a good job like that? Come on.
Oh, you got a score? you like diving?
You do well, do you? You like diving? What a job. John, let's go. Emily, I want to talk to you about the Blythe Star in a moment. John, can we talk to us about the search for the Montevideo Maru? Just quickly tell us what happened to it in the first place.
Yeah, so when the Japanese invaded Papua New Guinea, Rabaul, the northern coast, it happened really quickly. Australia only had a very small contingent of military up there, the Lark Force and a couple of others, and they were very quickly overwhelmed. Some managed to escape over the mountains to Port Moresby, which was a horrendous experience in itself. Others lost their lives in the fighting, and then the remaining 1,000-odd Australian military, as well as settlers, plantation owners, etc., were all rounded up and interned. And then the Japanese were building prison camps on Hainan Island in China at that time, which was occupied by Japan. And 1,000, as you've just mentioned, 1,000 internees were loaded aboard the Montevideo Maru. It was so named because it used to do the South American run back in peace times.
Okay.
And they were all sort of herded in below decks, and she set sail for China. And off the northern coast of the Philippines, she was sighted by an American submarine called the USS Sturgeon. She wasn't carrying any identification that it was a prisoner of war ship.
Right.
So they understandably thought it was just a regular Japanese freighter. They stalked it for a few hours. It was going too fast for them, and they waited till it slowed down, and then they fired several torpedoes. There's been questions as to one or two hit. We think it's two now from looking at the wreckage, but either way, the ship sank in 11 minutes. You can only imagine the horror of being locked below decks.
Because they would have been locked below decks.
They were locked below decks at 2:30 in the morning, in the middle of the ocean, people screaming and dying all around you.
Middle of the night, locked up downstairs.
They went straight to the bottom with zero survivors. There were Japanese survivors who made it to the top of the Philippines, and then most of them lost their lives as well in getting down to Manila, where the Japanese were. Only about 17 of them, I think, ever got back to Japan. So for all nations involved, there were many. It was overwhelmingly Australian, but there were also another 10 other nationalities. You just can't imagine the horror.
It's a war grave now, isn't it, as far as we're concerned?
Effectively, yes.
How did you find it? I mean, how would you... you'd need a precise location of where it sank, for a start. Was there one?
Well, that's the challenge. I mean, these days, I think Emily knows better than me, technology's pretty good, and Although the extreme depths that we were operating, it was sort of on the edge of technology. But really, it's all in the research and trying to find the right location to look.
Because that's the thing. When you go, I mean, anybody who's flown over the ocean or floated over the ocean knows it's all very well to say, oh, it's off the coast of Newcastle or it's off the coast, you know, like the Sydney. I mean, you know, it's we pretty much know where it is. In fact, they had a much more precise location in that sense too. But when you're out there floating in the ocean, as you know, it's a very different matter, isn't it?
It sure is. And so it was a 5-year journey before we actually went, and that was delayed a bit by COVID. But I was lucky enough to have a wonderful team. I had two experienced submarine commanders, ex-commander of a British nuclear submarine, Roger Turner, and then Tim Brown, who was Director General of Australia's submarines. And, you know, we spent many, many countless hours looking at all the data. There were three sort of locations given.
Was there a radio caller with the position that you had?
Yes, but, well, the Sturgeon gave a position in its log.
Yeah.
Then the position in the U.S. naval records was a different one. Okay. And then the Japanese Mayday call was another one. It wasn't a medical, but they recorded a different one again, all in a long way apart.
When you say long way, how long?
Well, many, many miles, tens of miles, which, you know, in the ocean, as you say, it looks on the map, it doesn't look too bad. When you get there, oh, my God, you know, it just stretches to the horizon.
So Emily, when you're floating on the surface of the ocean, they say you can't look any much further than about 9 kilometres in either direction, or is it a bit longer than 15, is it perhaps?
Well, I haven't been floating on the surface of the ocean in the middle of the ocean yet, thankfully. Yeah. But, so survey, like John said, archival research is usually one of the most important things that you can do when looking for a shipwreck. And then determining your survey area, your survey block, and then having the time and money and will to continue to search within that survey block until you are hopefully successful. So it can be a long slog.
So what do? You hatch, you choose your search area, and then you hatch it up, do you? And then say, well, we'll look at it hatch by hatch by hatch by hatch.
Basically, we spent a long, long time agreeing what we thought was the most probable position, MPP, which took into account all the data that we had. Currents, speed of the vessels, you know, errors. And remember, there's no GPS or anything in those days. So the submarine estimated, having traveled underwater in the night, they're estimating their position. So,
I was going to ask that. How did the submarine know where it was anyway? Because
you'd take land fixes when you could. So they would have had a land fix probably off the lighthouse on Cape Borodador, we would imagine. But then they would have done dead reckoning from there. They know they were travelling.
Totally dead reckoning, wouldn't it?
Dead reckoning.
We think these days, of course, you just look at the screen and there's your GPS reading. But then it's night. It's the middle of the night. They're not taking any sextant readings.
Exactly. So, and then we built from there concentric quadrangles of probability. Out so that we did the first quadrangle and then we moved to the second quadrangle. We surveyed about 400 kilometres of the seabed, square kilometres of the seabed, looking for it.
How soon did you find it?
About 3 weeks from when we started.
Okay.
But then we spent another close to a week making sure we had the right wreck, because that's that is the biggest fear of people like Emily and myself.
Right, Emily? On the bottom, can't be sure the one you're looking at, because there's lots of bricks down there.
There's nothing more terrifying than saying you found something and then having to say, oops, just kidding.
I'm not even going to mention the Endeavour.
Well, I'm happy to talk about the Endeavour.
No, we will in a moment. We will in a moment. So, Emily, how do you go and look for it anyway with a submarine? Well, how did you go and look for it, John? With a submersible, do you? A submersible submarine.
Yeah, it's kind of, bore you with too lengthy an explanation, but firstly, because at that depth, it's really hard, so you can't really use normal equipment like, you know, ROVs going around 100 metres down or whatever. It's just 4.5 kilometres down. So you basically map the seabed first so that you know what the actual terrain looks like. Then you send down basically an unmanned submarine that is programmed on a grid pattern that you program it to run over, and it floats along at about 100 metres above.
It's tethered, is it?
No, free.
It's not tethered?
No, it takes 2.5 hours to get down, and the same. And then it spends 40 hours down there, comes back up. Then you change the batteries, you download 6 terabytes of data, which you start processing of all the images and everything else, and then it's searching again. So by the time you see an image on the screen, it was probably 30 hours ago or more that you actually found it.
unlike, for example, like John's using really snazzy tech, you know, so that's autonomous underwater vehicles, which you can pre-program and do that, which is great. But
What do they cost each?
About 20 million US.
There you go.
Each.
As I said, snazzy tech. Yeah.
Each.
So you do. Well,
many times don't they come back? Sorry, Emily.
No.
Well, as you can imagine, the ship's owner is somewhat nervous about that. So we're saying we want a really low pass over the ship, and they're saying no way.
Emily, I'm thinking at 20 million bucks a pop, I know it doesn't have to be tethered. I'm going to attach it to a cable just in case.
Just like your watch chain. Keep it hanging there.
Because what if it goes rogue down there?
Well, then it's a very expensive exercise. Yeah, and it does happen.
I'm sure it happens.
Yeah. Oh, this is why there aren't that many deep water shipwrecks that are investigated. It's the same sort of concept with a lot of deep water marine research. It costs an absolute packet to get out there. Yeah,
we've talked about this before in the program, and it's hard to get your head around just how difficult it is to know about things under the surface of the water. You'd think, gee, we know everything about our planet. But it's often said, it's a cliche, I know, but we know more about the surface of Mars than we do about the deep water of the Earth. It's almost true, isn't it, Nebly?
Well, they do tend to, the deep sea biologists do get a little bit churdy about that one because we're learning more and more every day. But yes, there's still a heck of a lot that needs to be discovered. There's a wonderful initiative right now as part of the UN Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development, which is to map the entirety of the ocean floor at high resolution. And they're doing really well. In the last sort of decade, they've already mapped more of the ocean than they had in the previous 100 years.
How much of the ocean floor is mapped there? Not very much.
I think it's 25-26% now.
Yeah. Of the entire globe.
At high resolution, so that's and the more that they map, the more shipwrecks we'll find, right, John?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, I'm a bit older than Emily. We've been lucky to see the days where you're still, it's hard work and you spend hours on charts and maps and you flip zodiacs in the surf and diving and I think that the next generation are going to sit on the back of the ship with a glass of Chardonnay and the robots are just going to go up and down. And every now and again, it's going to go, bing, found one. And it is, okay, yeah, oh, yeah, that's it. So it's going to see me out.
But I think that's
the way it's going.
That's where the tech's going, is it?
You've got me over a barrel here because I like you, I like to be in the submersible. I like to be diving on the site. I like to be able to be a personal part of that history. But we have to look at what's going to be economically viable in the future. And it's just like the way a lot of oceanic technology is going. It's going autonomous because you can cover a lot more area at a lot lower cost.
You've been down to the Titanic, haven't you, Emily?
It is so.
Well, tell me about that.
I'm jealous of that.
it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I was much younger. I got lucky. I applied for a friend of mine had a website called Underwater Archaeology Jobs. He still has it. It's a great place. I highly recommend if people like maritime archaeology, they should go check it out. And he'd posted a thing that he'd heard about a documentary that was happening on Titanic called Last Mysteries of the Titanic. So I put in a video that I had my friend film on my back porch, and I got lucky. I got picked and I got to go to sea. And at the time I was a graduate student in maritime archaeology and I was working as a laboratory manager. So on artifacts and another archaeologist and I were able to go to sea with James Cameron on an investigation of the sort of the interior.
So you
of the
went down
section.
In the sub.
I did four times. Yeah. Mm.
Four times.
Do you like how I let you know that it was four times?
What's that like?
It was fantastic. Obviously.
Can you see much?
It's a really interesting experience, obviously. So the subs are, they're quite old. They were built in the 80s. They're Swedish and built and Russian maintained.
Are they tethered?
They are.
Thank heavens.
Yeah, so they're tethered. And you sort of climb in, and there are three people in those subs. So there was the camera operator, the director of photography, because it was a documentary film production, of course, which was fascinating to me as well. And the pilot, and then myself. And you do see the water change as you go down, and then there's not much for a while.
It becomes dark quite quickly, doesn't it?
It certainly does, as you descend through the layers of the ocean. And then you hit the bottom, and there's not a lot of visible life at first, but it is really, you know, we keep forgetting how much actually lives on the bottom of the ocean. We don't think about it as a vibrant and thriving ecosystem.
What did
you
look
really
at?
Is.
What did you look at? What part of the ship did you look at?
So the first time I saw Titanic was on the sonar. Uh-huh. You know, so it just popped up and it was just like this little blip and it was the bow section just sitting there. And you could really tell it looked like half a ship.
Uh-huh.
And so we explored the interior of the bow section. So Cameron had been there before doing imaging for his documentary projects and for the Titanic film. And we wanted to explore deeper within the wreck. So he had some special little micro ROVs, micro remotely operated vehicles developed that could fit through the windows of the wreck without really...
Wow.
You know, you really don't want to disturb the sediment or create any sort of negative action.
You could see these things going in through the window, could you?
You could, yeah. So they'd go in. Wow. So, well, what we did for the most part was you kind of hover the submersibles above the entry point on the grand staircase. So there was a glass dome there, and then it popped off. But that's the easiest way to access the wreck because you can just count decks as you go down. So you always know where you are to some extent in space and time. And then the other submersible would be positioned outside the wreck site, backlighting through the windows. Because, again, you know, you're getting this for film. So,
yeah. Wow. We're talking with Emily Jadiff, who's a marine archaeologist, a maritime archaeologist and curator of ocean science and technology at the National Maritime Museum. One of the great national resources here in Australia, of course, chaired by John Mullen, who's also with us, who is also the director of the Silent World Foundation and chairman of the Maritime Museum. It was the Titanic was probably one of the first big events in the world that alerted people to this technology and how you could do it, wasn't it, Emily?
Yeah, when
I mean the popular imagination.
When it was first found by Ballard and the joint French team. Yeah, I mean, I think we didn't really realize how far we could go. And John, of course, with Montevideo Maru has surpassed that depth.
The Montevideo is deeper than the Titanic.
A bit deeper, yeah.
How far can you go down?
Sorry, how?
How far can you go down?
There is technology to go to the bottom of the deepest point of the ocean.
The Mariana Trench.
Yeah. The Challenger Deep and some of these areas.
Humans have been down there, haven't they?
Yes. Quite a few.
But now, the amount of equipment that can actually go there on a sustained basis is just a handful in the world.
Hmm. Why can't we find the MH370, John?
I think because we haven't looked in the right place, quite simply. Interestingly, the vessel that we chartered for the Montevideo Maru and also for A1, our first submarine, we found the same vessel, was the vessel, the Fugro Equator, that was chartered by the Australian government for many months looking for MH370. Mm. And they, interestingly, came across a few wrecks from our era as well while they were looking for it, but they obviously didn't find the MH370. And I think the technology is pretty good. They're a first-class outfit, and I think if it had been there, they would have found it.
Yeah. When you say we're mapping the ocean floor in high resolution, Emily, that presumably means at some stage off the coast of Western Australia, if it is there, we would find it.
Yep.
Would we or not? I mean, does that show up in those kind of high-res pictures?
I think that's from a cultural heritage perspective, it is one of the most interesting things that about this high-resolution mapping initiative is all the shipwrecks that might and other sites that might be found that we aren't even looking for yet.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the time when we look for sites, it's because we know of them through history, through archival research. So we go looking for them for a specific reason. We have a research question. But there's so many times that vessels came to grief and didn't really make history. So it's about what we won't find or what we don't know about that we will find. So
the Blythe Star, which was found recently too, Emily, tell us about that. This is a merchant freighter that was sailing from Hobart to one of my old hometowns on King Island when it suddenly listed and sank. It's an extraordinary story in itself, isn't it? Because there were survivors and they were extremely lucky because no one found them and basically everyone thought they were dead. Why did the thing sink in the first place? Was the cargo shifted, didn't it? It was overloaded anyway.
Well, that's a really interesting question. One we were really kind of hoping to answer with the imagery. But while the imagery was fantastic, you know, to the point that you were even able to see, you know, the with the exception of finding the ship's bell getting imagery of the name of the vessel is the next best thing. Mm. So they were, the CSIRO were able to do that, which was fantastic. But it really weren't able to see anything through the recovered imagery that indicated any reason why the vessel sank. So there's a researcher, a historian named Michael Stoddard, who's really the one who kick-started this whole project, who's written a book about it, The Black Star Tragedy. And so, you know, the theories around why it sank are really that, you know, perhaps they accidentally sort of drained one of the ballast tanks a little bit too low, which caused the cargo to shift, which caused the vessel to list a little bit too far to starboard, which caused it, you know, to come to grief. And the imagery didn't show that there were any, that there was any other reason that the vessel might have sunk. And there was an inquiry after the sinking, because obviously, as you well know, growing up in the area, it was quite an outcry about the event.
It was a very, very moving event. I recall it as a kid when it happened. It was, you know, it affected people hugely. I think partly because of this realization of these people, the crew floating on the ocean, no one actually looking for them after a while because they'd all assumed they were dead. And you thought, why didn't they find them? They're floating in a raft, for heaven's sake.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like that human hubris. We think we can do things like find MH3, you know, so they weren't that far away. We spent a lot of money on this massive, huge marine rescue search and still didn't find them. So I think there was a lot of that they should have been found. It shouldn't have been able to happen, and yet it still did.
Mm. You found it. What happened? What happens now? You plot it, you photograph it, and then that's it, is it? No one's talking of raising it, of course. Why would you do that? But
we tend not to do that too much anymore. It is a quite an expensive process, and not always the best idea. Look, it all depends on the site, and I'll have John jump in here as well. But, you know, in the terms of the Black Star, it's in really good condition. Mm. It's in a really safe location. It's not likely to come to any damage. You know, it is a known artificial reef. It was a fishing snag before, which is one of the reasons that it was located. And I think that's actually a really important point to make, is that a lot of these times these vessels are known to fishers because they are artificial reefs where congregations, fishes hang out. And so there's a really valuable thing. A lot of the time people don't share the locations of shipwrecks because they're afraid they're going to be made protected zones and then they're not going to be able to fish in those areas. But you think about the positive outcomes of this, the finding the Bly Star for the descendants and the survivors of that voyage. And that's how, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be protected. So, you know, there's possibly a double positive there, you know, inspiration for reporting more sites.
Rob's on the line from Melbourne. G'day, Rob.
G'day, how you guys going?
Not bad.
I've seen on TV they've got that technology where they show like a computer image and then they drain the water away to reveal what's on the ocean floor.
No, yeah.
Would that help? Give you a clearer picture of what you're looking for? Or can that be used and you guys are doing?
Emily?
Yeah, they drain the oceans. That's a fantastic show. Yeah. I mean, it's a really great way to look at sites, Rob. I agree, because if you remove the water, then you can kind of see all aspects of the site. And one of the things, like with AE1, which John was really instrumental in doing, they performed 3D visualization of the entire site, which is sort of another way of really seeing it without any of the interfering fishes or flutter or anything like that. So absolutely. It's a great way to view a site.
Mm. And another thing, like especially if you've known there have been no survivors, I mean, wouldn't it be eerie going down there? Would their bodies still be there? I mean, wouldn't you sort of bring them to the surface and give them a proper burial, or would they just left down there?
Is it possible to even think about retrieving human remains, John?
Well, it's quite a difficult subject. Most human bodies deteriorate pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But that said, we've had a skeleton of one of La Perouse's crew from 1789 laid out on the mess room table of my boat, and that survived since 1789. It was repatriated to France. So they do survive, but I don't think there would be a lot left. It depends very much on the you know, cold water. Is it warm water? Are the currents all those sort of things? But it's unlikely. And you know, it's a given that you don't disturb human remains.
Yeah, they found where La Perouse's ships were shipwrecked. Did they?
Yeah, yes, yeah. They were found by there was two ships, the Boussole and the Astrolabe.
That's right.
And they were wrecked on Vanacura in Santa Cruz Islands. In the bottom of Solomon's. I've dived on them twice. Absolutely fascinating.
Right.
but they were found originally by a guy called Dumont d'Urville in 1829, and then there have been many expeditions and a lot of material raised and taken back to France, to Albi. There's a museum in Albi in France where that all resides today.
Mm. We're talking about what's under the water. John, tell us about Silent World Museum, which is yours. It holds an extraordinary collection of maritime memorabilia. What sort of things have you got there?
Well, it's something that sort of grew over the years. I actually grew up in southern Portugal and used to go and visit Prince Henry the Navigator's castle, where all the early Portuguese explorers set sail from, trying to get around the Cape. And I just started collecting, in those days, only books and things. But then over the time, more and more material, and I say it's a passion. My wife says it's an obsession, and we've eventually grew out of there was only space left in the house, so we made a private museum, which is where it all is. All is today. It's everything in this sort of area. The stuff that history tragics like us.
What's your best thing? What have you got?
Yeah, it's hard to answer, but we've got some quite. I like the sort of tactile things that these people touched. For instance, we have a first edition of Flinders' Atlas that Freycinet used on his circumnavigation of Australia with his pencil annotations.
Oh, wow.
Those sort of things. So I know that Freycinet himself actually turned that page and wrote notes in the margin, and I find those sort of things really exciting. The chronometer from the Beagle and Charles Darwin's circumnavigation, which came to Australia twice, actually.
Possibly the most important sea voyage ever undertaken.
Certainly up there.
I mean, you'd make an argument for it, couldn't you?
Absolutely.
It was the most important sea voyage ever, because after Darwin, the world was always different, forever.
Absolutely, yeah. And not many Australians know that Darwin called here.
He did. tell us a bit about that. Not many Australians do know this. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, well, he spent some time here, and he observed, went up to the Blue Mountains, spent a fair bit of time up there, and observed the platypus in particular. He was blown away by that. And the Beagle came here twice, because it came back a second time with under Captain John Lord Stokes, and surveyed a lot of the northeast coast of of Queensland.
Who owns shipwrecks, Emily? Does anybody own them?
How long have you got?
That's a really good question. Look, it humanity. I mean, they are a part of our sort of comprehensive, cohesive history. But there's a legislation that protects shipwrecks in Australian waters. So
right.
We have
that's what up out to the 200 kilometre.
We have state legislation that protects shipwrecks in inland waters and coastal waters, so that's out to 3 nautical miles. And then Commonwealth legislation protects shipwrecks out to the edge of the Commonwealth, out to the edge of the continental shelf. And then there is the Convention on the Protection of Underwater Cultural Heritage, which is a attempt to get states' parties to sign on to a sort of comprehensive preservation of shipwrecks located within the area, or, you know, the sort of both our waters and within the deep ocean, because a lot of sites that are located outside of states' parties' waters are not protected. Mm. You know, Titanic had to have its own specific legislation enacted, and it's only really relevant to the nations that decided to sign it.
Because it's in truly international waters, isn't it?
It Titanic. Sure is, yeah.
Yeah.
There are other conventions too. If it's a warship, traditionally it belongs to the flag state, pretty well wherever you find it. If it's a merchant ship, then, you know, if all the owners are extant, et cetera, but the thing that usually gets exciting is if there's money involved. So Emily and I, our treasure is historical, largely. But once you start finding millions of dollars, all bets are off.
I was talking about that, I was thinking about that because I was reading a story of allegations that a Chinese ship had been taking things from a wartime wreck in off Indonesia, I think it was.
HMS Perth.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know whether this story was true or not, but there were suggestions that it was true. But in essence,
it is
true. In essence, if you find it, you can salvage from it, can you?
Well, this was illegally done. Yeah. There's a market, again, not everybody knows, it's a bit obscure, but there's quite a market for steel that was produced pre the atomic explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Why?
Because for very delicate scientific instruments, all steel produced today still got traces of radioactive elements in it. And so that steel's quite
fascinating.
Hang on, rewind here. You're joking.
No, I'm afraid that's true. As a result, old warships that aren't too deep. I mean, Titanic and Montevideo Mare depth, it's beyond technology today, but they were quite shallow, those ones. And now they just anchor a pretty great big barge above it, and they send down grabs, and they just grab the whole lot and pack it on. HMS Perth is just a sort of imprint on the sand where it used to be. It's absolutely tragic. Together with many hundreds of people who lost their lives, of course.
Luckily, some of the museum archaeologists were able to visit it and take some video of the site before that happened. But what John says is absolutely true. There's a huge market for it.
It's for the steel, and they sell the steel to scientific instrument makers.
Yeah.
I find that astonishing. I've never heard such.
Well, I think I'm right, aren't I?
Absolutely.
I'm not disbelieving you. It's really just quite extraordinary. What we've talked a lot about shipwrecks around the. Oh, actually, I should talk to you about this little story in Australian history, which Australians did not know anything about, and that was the sinking of that iron ore carrier in Bass Strait by a Japanese submarine. You were involved with the finding of that too, I think, were you, Emily?
Absolutely. That was a project with CSIRO RV Investigator. Mm. So we did it was 2019, and we were surveying for sites in Bass Strait. And again, this is the result of hours and hours of fantastic archival research by the MAAV team, which is the Maritime Archaeological Association of Victoria, who said, go look here and you might find the Iron Crown. And so after a night of sweaty palms and a heck of a lot of surveying, we were actually able to locate it in 700 meters of water within Bass Strait.
Yeah. I mean, I only mention this story because I think most Australians have no idea about that this happened, because we know about the midget subs in Sydney Harbour, but for reasons of national security and censorship at the time, Australians were never told that Japanese submarines were active off the east coast of Australia and sank Australian merchant shipping in Bass Strait.
Very active, actually. There are maps that exist that show how many ships were sank, which was quite a few. And merchant navy vessels were particularly under attack, because whilst they were somewhat trained in defensive operations, they really just didn't have the armament to really have much of an impact. So it was just sort of a cross your fingers and hope for the best. And so these guys didn't really have that much of a chance. When the submarine surfaced, they sunk within 60 seconds, and 38 of the 43 crew died. So we were very honored to be able to find that site and to be able to shed a light on the role of the merchant navy during World War II, which is often forgotten.
Yeah, indeed. 1-300-800-222. Line's free if you want to grab one. We're talking about what's underneath the ocean with John Mullen and Emily Jatiff. They're both from the National Maritime Museum. Well, John's got other jobs, but this is why he's here tonight. I'm sure this is the most fascinating part of his life too.
By far.
What would you like to find, John?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a good one. We've probably found 20 or 25 shipwrecks over the years. There's a limit to what you go on looking for, but I'm particularly fascinated by very early colonial history and exploration wrecks, but also mysteries like A1, our first submarine. I think there've been 12 expeditions to find it.
Yeah.
Before we were lucky enough, Montevideo Maru, obviously. But there's some other great mysteries out there. Amelia Earhart, for instance, again, one of our boats has been chartered by one of the many expeditions looking for that without success.
No one's ever found it.
No.
Or her, have they? No.
It's there somewhere on the seabed. I think there are all sorts of stories.
It's pretty clear, isn't it?
Bones being found.
Don't you think it's pretty clear from what we know that she probably did land and probably survive on that island?
I don't think so, because it was Howland Island.
Howland Island.
It was set up for her to land on to refuel, and they were waiting for her, and there were radio calls, and she couldn't find it, and then eventually it went quiet. So I think the most likely is she, while trying to find it, she ran out of fuel and went into the sea somewhere near. But again, it's a big sea. You see a little island, you think, oh, just search around here. Yeah, it's a hard one.
You can do that one, John.
Well, in recent years, I thought one of the most extraordinary finds was the was Shackleton's ship, the Endurance, which was found in extraordinary state of preservation. Emily, is that because it's in the Antarctic waters? I mean, in other words, is the colder the water, the better the state of preservation?
It's true, but like John just said, I was totally shocked that they found it, actually. I never thought it would be found, because Endurance was stuck in the pack ice and it got crushed. And so I thought, nah, it's just been absolutely
I would have bet
smashed.
My bottom dollar it drifted 1,000 miles before it sank.
So it was fantastic. And then they got such stunning imagery. Cool. But Antarctica is a fascinating one for me. I mean, it's completely unacceptable for me to say this, because the reason... Antarctic sea ice is melting, which is a really bad thing. Mm. But there's this tiny little cultural heritage part of me that is really interested by what we might find as that sea ice melts. And obviously the rest of the world is then in greater danger. But gosh, I wonder if we'll find something interesting down there on the way. So forgive me in advance for that statement.
Mm. No, and the same thing happened in the north of Franklin's ships, Erebus and Terror in the north. And
the search for the Northwest Passage. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
And the preservation in those areas is usually phenomenal. You know, cold water, low oxygen environments. You are really it's one of the best types of environments, like Scandinavia or the Black Sea, even, where preservation is absolutely phenomenal, and you will find wrecks sitting almost proud on the
seabed. Is that the reason, essentially, John, that the search? I mean, you know, these fascinating speculations. They are only that about. Earlier discoveries of Australia. It's pretty clear, I think, there was a wonderful display of maps, and this would not be news to you, there was a wonderful display of maps at the National Library some years ago, which, when you looked at it in the world's collection of maps about Australia, I think if you really think now that Cook was the first to see it, then you're kidding. You're kidding yourself. He probably almost certainly wasn't. He didn't think he was either, probably, because he knew that others had been there before him. Now, there's been speculation as to who was, and of course everything from the great Chinese junks to the mahogany ships, which are supposedly in the sands on the sand dunes off Victoria. But given the effluxion of time, are we never going to know anything about these things, do you think?
I think so. And every time we dive on the reef and we look for an old cannon or something, I'm hoping that we'll find the Portuguese armillary sphere or a sketch on it, because... Look, the first known European arrival was the Dyfken in April 1606, and then Luis de Torres sailed through the Torres Strait the same year, a few months later, and although there's no record, he must have landed on one of the islands, I think. So we know that, 1606, but the Portuguese were in Timor 68 years before that, and to think they came all the way from Little Portugal and they never went the extra week sailing to Australia, it's... hard to beat. There's no proof.
It doesn't seem likely, does it? No.
There's no proof, and there are lots of theories and the Dieppe maps you've probably heard of, and if you hold the map up this way and you look at it in the mirror, it looks like the coast of, there's lots of ardent theories, but there's no evidence. I don't think the Chinese, I don't think that's a credible story. They certainly got a long way down Asia. I don't think there's any evidence of getting here. So I believe it's highly likely the Portuguese got here before.
It's possible, therefore, that you could find something, because they had material culture which would have survived, a cannon, an anchor, metal of something.
There was a guy called Mendonça who sailed with three ships from, I think, Kupang or somewhere, and he sailed southeast for several months, came back with just one ship, and the only reason we know is he'd dined with a British East India captain in the ship, and he recorded that he'd sailed for several months into this land of flies and sand and heat, and he lost two ships and came back. And where was that? There's no proof, of course, but you'd have to think if he went southeast from Indonesia for a few months and you saw a land of lots of flies and sand, it's likely to be Australia. But again, tantalizing, and there's no evidence, and we have to... In our world, we have to live on proof.
Paul's on the road from Albany. G'day, Paul.
Hey, mate, how are you?
Not bad.
I just wondered if you guys had an opinion on the thistle gall, if that's too modern for them, really.
What is it, again?
The thistle gall is a ship that sunk in Egypt, a military ship, and it's still got all the trucks, the motorbikes, the weapons, everything's still on board.
What, a World War II thing, is it?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
And I just wondered what your team thought of that, or if it was just too modern for them to really be looking at.
I'm ashamed I don't know the name.
Yeah, so, no. Sorry, Paul, same, but, you know, look, there's actually quite a lot of extant World War II material across the world and in the Pacific particularly. We did a bunch of work a few years ago in the Marianas Islands, where in the wake of action, the U.S. military just sort of pushed everything off the edge of the cliff because it was the easiest way to get rid of it. And so a lot of that stuff is spread out all over it. And now they're starting to make cultural heritage trails in those areas so that people can dive on the tanks and the airplanes.
Around the Solomons, there's heaps of stuff, isn't there?
Yeah.
Million-dollar point in Vanuatu, same.
This one was hit by a missile, and it literally sunk as it was in the water, and it's still sat there today. And I've dove it a few times, and it's in about 40 metres of water, so it's not a really deep one, but it's pretty fascinating to go and have a look at.
I imagine it would be. Thanks, Paul. Philip from Newcastle. G'day, Philip.
G'day there, Philip. Just a question on the Iron Knight. Have you got any information on that? I think it was found once, and it was found to be false. It was the last ship, BHP ship, he sank. I think it was off Bermagui down there. Is there any information on that vessel?
Yeah, I'm aware of the Iron Knight. There's not much more information on the vessel that I could share, but there is some archival research that I can share and some images of that. If you're interested, do contact the National Maritime Museum and we'll share with you what we've got.
Okay. Phil, I'll put you back to on hold. And we'll grab. Can we just leave Philip's details there and we'll put you in contact with him. There are other things down there too, aren't there, Emily, other than shipwrecks? Of course, shipwrecks is a fascinating thing to talk about. But there are also other things that you're looking at too. Tell us about submerged indigenous sites.
Well, yeah, this is one of the reasons we call it underwater cultural heritage, because it can be so much more. And particularly so submerged sites, investigation sort of prehistoric submerged sites in Europe has been a field for quite a while, and it's now a really great growing discipline here in Australia. And over the last few years, there have been some very significant finds, in particular with the Murujuga sites, with the Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation over in WA, and a collaborative team from Flinders University and Queensland and WA. They were able to locate some stone tools that are believed to be collected from below the waterline that are over 7,000 years old, which is really indicative of that sort of understanding that people were living and working below what is today's waterline, so back when sea levels were much lower. So it's really expanding our knowledge of occupation and habitation of Australia. So it's incredibly important. And I believe it will be uncovered in a upcoming ABC a documentary series called The First Inventors later this month. So there's a little plug there.
There we go. Now, sadly, we were never on the sea lanes from the gold rich kingdoms of Mexico and Peru, so there are no treasure ships off the coast of Australia, are there, John? Not really.
I don't think so. No. I mean, there's some interesting and tantalising things. I can't remember the name of it now. The ship that sank from after the gold rush, carrying a lot of, but it was gold. Mainly gold dust, so it wouldn't have survived. And the trouble is, a lot of those ships, they sort of left Sydney. They didn't arrive in London. And
no one knows where they are.
Quite a lot of sea to search along the way. So you've got to be a little bit more precise than that to look for these things. I mean, we did look for, there was some treasure found, Spanish silver dollars, worth about $1 million in today's money, I think, that was found by a vessel called, I think it was the Lancashire Lass, owned by Frank Jardine, up in North Queensland, in Torres Strait, about 900 k's north of Cape York. And that was all raised by the Lancashire Lass, but we went to try and find the boat. We think it was probably the Sun. At the time, they said it was a Spanish ship, but I don't think there's any evidence of that. there is tantalising. There is one coin in the Powerhouse Museum that came from that selection. So we spent quite a torrid month. There's no anchorage. We just had to bob up and down because the reef is just 1,000 metres straight down. We searched it. We found wreckage. We found an anchor down at 40-something metres down. Found chain, all sorts of stuff, but we didn't find any silver.
And even if we find it, as you've said, explained, Emily, it's not yours anyway.
Now you have to put it in a museum.
Yeah. Yeah. You can keep, I mean, everything has to be declared. The rules are very, very strict.
It's not that you can't keep it, actually, is it?
Well, you can, there's some still, I mean, we have a fair bit, you know, we have coins from the Batavia and the Gilt Dragon and things like that in our museum, but they're all registered with the WA Museum. They've got numbers, and I think you're just actually, you're the custodian. The state can call it back at any time.
One day they'll be called back in. John's hidden
them by then.
John's in Launceston. Hi, John.
G'day.
You've got a handwritten diary from when?
From 1876,
right.
Two young fellows who left one of Her Majesty's ships, and they sailed all the way out to Hobart, and then eventually ended up in Victoria. They are relatives of mine.
Right,
fantastic.
And I just thought that I've got this diary sitting at home. It's a small, like a spiral pad, and it just it's handwritten in pencil, dated. Of all the ongoings that were happening on the boat on the way across.
You're probably thinking, how do I preserve it?
Well, I am. I mean, I've transcribed some of it as best I can. It's a little bit illegible in spots, but I heard somebody say they were connected with the National Maritime Museum, and I thought, well, there's a place to go. Mm.
Emily, just in terms of material culture, what do you do with an object like that?
Well, I would recommend there's a wonderful group of people at the Maritime Museum of Tasmania who I'm sure would be fascinated to have a chat with you and look at your journal, you know, because it's always good to check with your local museum first as well, you know. But logbooks are incredibly important because they're those personal views of the journey, or they're the ones that tell you how. So I'll just sort of digress there momentarily. There's a really cool guy in New Zealand who's looking at logbooks from the 19th century to sort of understand a little bit more about weather patterns during the period, which helps us to understand changes in climate and what the climate was like then and now. So I just think that's a great way of using material culture for a modern problem.
Yeah, show it to them, John.
Take it to the Maritime Museum of Tasmania.
They're not going to pinch it off you, but I mean...
No.
The other thing I'd
just like to make sure that it doesn't deteriorate any further. It's in reasonably good condition,
Absolutely. Is it a spiral notebook?
And sort of.
Yeah. I think the easiest thing is...
No, sorry, it's not spiral. It's glued at the back, so... Some of the pages are becoming...
Glues can be a bit difficult. So, yeah, I would highly, if you're worried about it deteriorated, just bring it into the Maritime Museum and have them take a look at it, because as John well knows, conservation of finds is probably one of the hardest and most important aspects of the research.
Yeah. But it's so nice to hear you treasuring it. You know, I'm talking against my own interests, but we have quite a few things in our museum where... It's been in, the objects like that have been in families for many years and then sold by the descendants, and you should hang on to it.
Hang on to it, yeah, exactly. Hang on to it, John, thanks. All right, look how fast time flies when you're having fun. We've got such great stuff in our museums of Australia, and if you've never visited the Maritime Museum, if you're ever in Sydney, you should do so. And there's magnificent maritime museums, of course, in Western Australia too, the Shipwreck Museum, which is one of the great treasures of Australia.
Sure is.
As well.
Absolutely.
John Mullen, Director of the Silent World Foundation, and Emily Jatiff, both of the National Maritime Museum as well. Thanks for coming in.
Great pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate your time.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.